everyone, and welcome to the Transatlanticist podcast at the American Centrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola, and today we'll be discussing the recent regional elections in Thuringia and Saxony in East Germany. We will also be introducing you to two politicians whom you perhaps have never heard of, Björn Höcke, leader of the Alternative for Germany, or Alternative for Deutschland, or AfD party in Thuringia, and Zara Wagenknecht, the leader of a brand new political party that, in a hilariously narcissistic way, is named after herself, the Bündnis Zara Wagenknecht, or the BSW. This might be translated as the Zara Wagenknecht Confederation or the Zara Wagenknecht Alliance, and I think Donald Trump might be a little bit jealous of her brand strategy. But anyway, with me to discuss all things politics in Germany is our resident EU expert, Dr. Günter Donner. Welcome back, Günter. How is your summer?
Terrific. Fantastic weather in Sweden. 7 weeks.
Very nice. Okay, so let's have a look at some headlines that I saw after the elections in Thuringia and Saxony, which took place on the 1st of September. One screamed, "Far right on a roll in Germany." Another screeched, "Germany could hardly go more right-wing." Most worryingly, AfD becomes first far-right party to win German state elections since the Nazis. And Scholz urges firewall against far-right after elections. So what happened? Well, the far-right AfD won the most votes in Thuringia and the second most votes in Saxony. The newly formed party, the Bündnis Zara Wagenknecht, earned 16% in Thuringia and 12% in Saxony. We can make fun of her party name, but we can't make fun of those strong results. Given that the parties of the ruling coalition of the federal government in Berlin, the SPD, the Greens, and the FDP, were almost completely wiped out. So just so you realize how important this is, combined, the governing coalition in Berlin earned less than a third of what the AfD earned, so 10% to over 30%, and also less than this brand new Zara Wagenknecht party, so which goes to show you how unpopular the government of Berlin is. In better news for the CDU, the center-right party of ex-Chancellor Merkel, they roughly stayed the same from the previous election. So they got 23% in Thuringia and 32% in Saxony. So Günter, when you saw those election results coming in on Sunday night when you were away in Sweden, what was your first reaction?
Well, in fact, it didn't come as any type of surprise. This was foreseeable. If you regularly maintain contact with the situation, the rather special political situation in East Germany, above all in Thuringia, you couldn't be caught by surprise. I was a bit surprised, however, that in Saxony, the CDU came out first. Well, so it was then. I would have expected worse, to be honest. In Thuringia, it was a clear thing. My reading was that was what I expected. There was little that could have been done against it during the short time of a campaign. It's a symptom. I should call it rather a symptom than a massive crisis. I mean, in Thuringia, we talk about roughly 2 million people. This is 1/14 of the German population. And what is considered shrewd there may deviate enormously from what people feel in other parts of Germany with far more inhabitants. But one should, of course, not turn a blind eye to this. And I was a little bit shocked that the normal phraseology came again. And now it's a blame game that's going on. Who talks with whom about what? And there are a few particularities regarding the individual constitutions of the two states, which make it even more difficult.
And here I just want to break in to remind our audience that no single party won a majority in Indeed. The state of Thuringia or the state of Saxony. Just a couple of numbers mm-hmm. here. The Thuringia state legislature has 88 seats. The AfD won 32. The CDU won 23. The BSW won 15. And then fewer and fewer seats of the remaining. But the point there is that the AfD won the most seats, but not enough for a majority. So they have to either work with another party. The BSW would take them to a majority that would give them 47 of the required 45 seats for the majority. Mm-hmm. But the CDU, for example, which has 23 seats, would have to work with like a number of other parties to get a governing coalition. So when, mm-hmm. when you were talking about all of these, who can talk with whom about what, we're talking about which parties are going to join together to form a coalition government mm-hmm. in both Thuringia and Saxony. And of course, given that one headline that I read, the AfD is the first far-right party to win a regional or state election since the Nazis, who wants to work with the AfD? Gunther.
Yeah, hopefully nobody. But the thing again is we have to set apart the idea of working with in a parliament where you sit confined in a certain screen space to work with or to form a coalition, forming a coalition with the right, with the extreme right wing party, be this Saxony or be this Thuringia, is completely out of the question. This will not happen. At the state level, you have to set apart. We had the same discussion after the by-elections somewhat earlier this year. Is it possible that in Village X, a decision in the communal council could be brought about? I just set an example. We will build two more traffic lights, yes or no? And now you say no because the AfD says yes. That doesn't make any sense to me. As soon as the venom of extremists' political views starts to enter your body, that is, we in Thuringia now put paid to military aid for Ukraine, or we in Saxony will have a referendum whether or not the NATO should station Tomahawk missiles on our soil. This has nothing to do with the state legislature, nothing. And it's not decided there. That was just fishing in rather dirty water in order to reap together as much of public discontent as possible. These two extremist parties have no conception for whatever problem, nothing, absolutely nothing. What they are masters of, and they are masterminds, that is, put a name and a culprit tag to issues and reap as many of the dissatisfied, disillusioned voters as possible by telling them what they would at this very moment like to hear. A solution, pensions, investments, better prospects for small and middle enterprise, all this has nothing to do with their political convictions. They are rat catchers.
Yeah, Gunther, you were just minimizing the importance of the strength of these parties in mm-hmm. the East, but maybe we should be a little bit more cautious about this because, for example, in Thuringia, even if the AfD is excluded from being in the ruling party of a coalition government there, mm-hmm. they still have a strong enough minority that they can prevent, for example, judicial appointments. Mm-hmm. And don't they also receive like intelligence briefs and updates and get privileged information that only government officials get? So they are worming their way into important matters of the law, the German Constitution, the mm-hmm. Constitution of the State of Thuringia, mm-hmm. of policing matters. They can decide, are they going to go hard after right-wing extremists or not? So, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not entirely sure that we can just write off the AfD as being all, as we say in English, all bark and no bite. They are certainly mostly bark, but the more they win, the more bite they have, too.
Well, I fully agree with you. I'm not happy about this result. How could one be? But the thing is now, we have to live with it. As long as the AfD remains a party and part and parcel of our democratic system and is not forbidden, and I have my personal reservations, it might come to this one day. I have no idea. I think that democracy has to withstand the challenges of extremist political convictions as long as these do not actively attempt to destroy the constitutional order of the country in question. We had this way back in history. Extremism is nothing new in post-war German history. In those days, it was left-wing extremism. The GDR was on the doorstep, so was the KGB. They were sponsoring left-wing parties in West Germany for clearly political and, if not military, reasons. So we had bans and all this, and panic. The thing is, this is it's a new development. It's a negative development. There is no doubt about it. But what will they ultimately deliver in a situation as we have it now? Can they deliver? So much depends, much will depend on how the other parties, and I don't put a very great difference between the Bündnissaar Wagenknecht and the AfD. It's not six of one and half a dozen of the other, but certain approaches are almost congruent.
Yeah, before we get into the similarities and differences between these two parties, let's just introduce the key players. So Zara Wagenknecht's was a left-wing politician, a senior figure in Die Linke, or the Left Party, and she split from them. And the second figure we need to discuss is in the AfD, the mm-hmm. leader of the AfD, and who could be the governor of the land of Thuringia, potentially, if he finds a coalition partner, retired or a one-time historian, public school historian, mm-hmm. And I guess someone we can legally call a fascist mm-hmm. by the name of Björn Höcke. And it's interesting that we can call him a fascist because he tried to sue some people for defamation for calling him a fascist. And the court said, actually, he can be legitimately described as a fascist, which again is very disturbing in a number of ways. So, Günther, tell me a little bit more about Frau Wagenknecht, yeah. And then we'll turn to Höcke.
Zara Wagenknecht was born in 69 in Jena in Thuringia. She has been active in many left-wing political parties. She started in the SED, that was the communist state-run party in East Germany. She went over to the PDS, Partei des Demokratischen Sozialismus, the direct copycat of the SED, just renamed.
After the wall came down.
After the fall of the Iron Curtain and the breakdown of the pro-Soviet regime there. So the PDS was a relabeled SED minus a certain amount of those who had probably a rendezvous with the public prosecutor for whatever they did during the East German dictatorship. Zara Wagenknecht has never concealed a extreme theoretical and arch-conservative, if I may say so, we call the Stalinist, pro-Stalinist, communist political stance. She has justified much of what Stalin did in terms of industrialization, and she's remained silent on the fate of millions of Russian Soviet people sacrificed for Stalin's policies. So that was the classical communist East German approach of the old school, not the Gorbachev school. That would have made it something totally different. She's a flamboyant person. She's fascinating. She's interesting to listen to. She is highly intelligent. She's growing older as well, and she's probably getting more and more vain. In former times, she was a diplomatist of an outstanding quality. She was in Brussels 2004 to 2009 as a member of the European Parliament for the extreme left. And it was a pleasure to listen to many of her presentations. She was well informed. She had something to say. I mean, you probably couldn't agree to it, but at least it wasn't blah, blah. There was too much blah, blah in those days. So Wagenknecht is a very multi-faced and rather interesting personality. Maybe now with age progressing, vanity, takes over, maybe. So her career is, she left Brussels for the Bundestag, and in 2009 she became a member of the Deutsche Bundestag, the national parliament, for the Linke, where she played a very ambitious role. She was a given leader, a born leader. She was on stage and all attention was hers. She was engaged. That was clear. I mean, most of what she finally came up with in terms of solutions, that was crap. But the way she presented it, in many, that's what
she's a charismatic politician.
More than that. In the later years, she seemed to become more and more open to intrigue. So she always killed the Linke, her own former party. She let it implode. I mean, the leftovers of the Linke at the federal level are ruins, complete ruins. You mentioned it rightly. She now created a new, not a new left party, but the Bündnis Sahra Wagenknecht. That is her own brainchild, and that is she and no one else. She's a very nationalistic person. Please bear that in mind, because for the future evaluations, it may have some value.
Okay, we're going to keep that in mind because we're going to evaluate her a little bit more and her policies later. But let's move on to Bjørn Höcke, the fascist. Oh, well. I mean, we laugh, but it is bad that someone, the head of a political party in Germany, is someone that we can call a fascist.
Yes, but please, Andy, please do me a favor. This word fascist lacks all definition. The classical and, to me, the sole permitted definition is a member of Mussolini's Movimento Fascista.
Okay, well, now you're being very, very, very technical and historical. I would agree with you from a technical and historical perspective.
Through all my years of professional debate and discussion, I lived to see the idea, who is not of my opinion, who is not part of what I think and who doesn't support it, is what is really abominable. And what is abominable? A fascist. But what makes a fascist, and how a fascist looks today in Germany, in East and West Germany, in Italy, in England, we now have right-wing hooligans, they were called when I was a kid. They were as dangerous. Now they run about with right-wing messages, but they were violent. Now, the thing with a fascist is one thing. Whether Höcke or not is a fascist, to me, plays no role. His ideas, his convictions, and the way many of his utterances in public are dramatic. And he is, in several cases, been in the courts for this. So Höcke is a very problematic figure. To compare him, well, just about his data, he was born in 72. He comes from West Germany, noteworthy.
I did not know that.
Yes, from Hesse. He moved to Thuringia, so he learned very early how can an extreme. There was no really breeding ground for an extreme right wing party. There have always been Nazis, and I'm old enough to know them. I know them very well. Those were the ones an arm and a leg was missing. They were there in the Second World War. They had their contribution for the Nazi realm. And that was the 50s and the 60s, which I vividly, the 60s I vividly remember when I first came to Germany. So those were the old school Nazis. They were there when the Nazi realm was in full swing. Then came the second generation. That was a long distance of transition because they started as youngsters in the Hitlerjugend and then they grew up, became politicians in the 50s. But they still had ties, personal ties to these Third Reich in inverted commas. Now, later, we talk about imitators and would-be Nazis, whatever.
So would you say Höcke is part of the second or the third generation?
The third.
So he's...
He's 72, I mean, Jesus Christ.
He's a post...
He's a post-NPD type.
Post-NPD type.
We had
the National Party.
Yeah, we had the old type of extreme right parties, and they were never in the federal parliament in West Germany. They had no chance, but in certain Länder, state legislative bodies, they were well represented. They never lasted for long. Somebody disappeared with what was left in the travel expense money box or whatever. They normally had a disgraceful end. So the AfD, when it came into being, wasn't a Höcke type of party. It was a right-wing, anti-European, above all, anti-Euro nationalistic movement run by a lot of professors, if I may say so. Economists, mostly, some others, but mostly economists. And one by one, Höcke managed to transform this institution into a Bewegung, a movement for open to the extreme right, not to elitist EU critical professors. They could never win an election in Thuringia. They wouldn't be understood. So what Höcke did was he is a mastermind of infiltrating the party structures. He managed to perfection. And now the AfD at the federal level is just a Jody and Punch theater, and he's the puppeteer. So that's what comes of it. And why did he go to Thuringia? Because he realized that is the weak spot. Thuringia is rural, rather poor, lots of dissatisfaction. They compare with everybody, and they think they lose. Many do. And very little has been achieved there. So he went there, and he established himself there, and that's what he made his breeding ground for his movement called the Flügel, the wing or the aisle. So Höcke isn't, if you compare him to Wagenknecht, he's not an intellectual at all. I mean, an intellectual would never come up with statements that immediately call for legal indictments or whatever. You wouldn't do that. He does
just,
it.
Just to remind the audience here, Höcke has been dragged into court for saying certain things that would be legal in the U.S.,
yes,
like Holocaust denial or Holocaust minimalization or stuff about the Third Reich, that is illegal to say in Germany. In the U.S., it's fine, but Germany has pretty strict denazification laws. And so he does say things. Can you give me an example? I think once he gave the old Nazi stormtrooper slogan at a political rally. And does he do the Hitler salute?
That to me was probably quite a harmless thing. That was a phrase. And of course, a phrase used by the Nazis. But the Nazis used many phrases, a part of the German language. He was indicted for that. Worse were his condescending and derogatory comments on the Holocaust. Really disgusting. And I mean, I'm proud that in this country you see yourself in the courtroom if you speak out in a way about Germany's horrific past. What you could easily do in America, you could walk about with a swastika flag. If you do this here, you end in jail.
So Höcke really gets right up to the line of legality with his far right views.
He does it on purpose.
Yeah.
Because he wants to amass all those waiting for somebody to pronounce, to say the unspeakable, mm-hmm, to think the unthinkable and to let the world know that there is opposition to this enforced German neutrality or whatever anti-German attitude. And of course, this flourishes in the East more than it does in very rich and well-doing states like Baden-Württemberg or Bavaria or Hessen or Hamburg. He would have never had any success here. Never. Right.
Okay, so let's move on to actually talking about the similarities and differences in AfD and Bündnis-Azov-Wagenknecht policies. And I've been having a difficult time finding differences because it seems that, you know, they're both pro-Russian.
Yeah.
They're both anti-American.
Oh, yeah.
They're both anti-EU. They're anti-NATO.
Yeah.
They want Ukraine to roll over and surrender to the benevolence of Russia and Putin. They're, in that respect, anti-Ukraine. And, of course, they're anti-immigrant. So, for me, it's hard to see, like, what distinguishes a Bündnis-Azov-Wagenknecht voter from an AfD supporter. To me, it seems like what both of these politicians are saying are the same thing. So why would you say I'm voting for the AfD instead of I'm voting for the BSW?
There are similarities, but there are massive differences.
Okay, and focus on those differences.
The difference is in which historic order does the party appear? The AfD clearly stands in line with its predecessors of pro-right, extreme right-wing or ex-Nazi or relabeled Nazi parties. The Germans had, it started in the early 50s. we once had a mayor of the island of Sylt, now one of Germany's most luxurious resorts, who was called the hangman of Warsaw. He was a mass murderer. That was in the 50s. He became mayor there, but he managed
to. And he became a CDU politician after.
No. Sorry. No, I have to correct you. He wasn't a CDU politician. He was a Bündnis der Heimatvertriebenen und Entrechten, an extreme right, one of the extreme right parties popping up after the Second World War. So there's a continuity of extreme right movements from the early days of the West German state, right until the AfD. But there was a cleavage. The cleavage was the AfD wasn't considered was not founded by old Nazis. They were all dead. It was founded by highly intellectual upper class people criticizing the EU and the Euro thing and this debt policy, how we stabilized the euro and whether or not that was a wise idea or not. It started in a very theoretical fashion and gradually, and that was Höcke's task and a few others, but Höcke was the dominant figure. He usurped the party. You may know this from America. He usurped the party, but not. He didn't make it into a personal cult. The Höcke, there is much less of a Höcke cult than there is of a Wagenknecht cult. Höcke isn't the figure to love. Höcke isn't a figure to revere. He is just a guy in the back room pulling the strings, and that he does to perfection for his to reach his goal. You have to admit it. So he stands in line with an old tradition of extreme right, suddenly relabeled ex-Nazi parties, and the AfD now is nothing but this. With the added momentum and weight of East Germany in past falling victim to the bait and tackle this party has to offer. The Bündnis-Wagenknecht is a bit different. It's traditional, nostalgic, hardcore communism, and don't get the idea wrong. There were plenty of supporters for hardcore communism in former East Germany. I remember my first lectures there, and you had them all sitting there because only the privileges could go to university, and they, of course, had to pay to revere the overall political conception. So there was much disappointment. There was much from the start, and that started with the West knows everything better. The West is our new master, our new colonial master. There was misbehaving Western people in East Germany, no doubt about it. What was Western was pro-American. So anti-Americanism clearly is a common denominator, but it goes much deeper than AfD and Bündniswagenknecht in East Germany. Anti-Americanism is a hallmark of system critics in East Germany and beyond. Anti-Americanism has to be understood not just anti-Trumpism. That is a new hallmark of the left. Anti-Americanism is anything that has with globalization, global power, global context, global cooperation, anything that just goes above the average things you see. So church tower politics. Whatever is global, the EU is intransparent. Of course, it's murky and intransparent. But nobody knows it. If they explain, nobody comes and listens. So this is one hallmark, anti-Americanism. They share. But the Zaha-Wagenknecht alliance is much more subtle in terms of how to reach people's economic needs. What you read and hear from the AfD in terms of economic conceptions, solutions, and projects is just nonsense. You don't hear anything. They concentrate on a few issues, and ironically speaking, these issues are totally out of touch with what at state level could be decided upon. I mean,
and I might say not only that, also out of touch with reality.
Indeed.
And I want to get into some of the difference between voter reality or reality in Thuringia and Saxony.
Indeed.
What politicians claim the case is versus what it really is.
And let me add one more common factor, that is opportunism. Both. Höcke is clearly he's an opportunist. He knows where to start his what and how far he could go. And if negative, and please bear in mind, because that's an American, that's interesting message for Americans. Negative propaganda remains propaganda. If you're talked about in a negative context, you're still talked about.
This is the genius of Donald Trump. He understood this from the first.
That's it. And, well, the other thing is that the Wagenknecht thing, they go on to the nostalgic thing. It wasn't all so bad, she once. I think it's even part, you can read it in Wikipedia, but it's unbelievable. She once called the German Democratic Republic, so the East for East Germany, the most peaceful and humane system the Germans have ever managed to create in their history. That was a system blowing those wishing to leave this highly paradise of the workers by mines, by booby traps, or shooting them right in the back.
Or simply torturing them at their torture prison in Hohenschönhausen.
Indeed.
And maybe we should take Frau Wagenknecht on a tour of the prison and maybe have some inmates describe what happened to this most peaceful of regimes.
She might have another date, and that might keep her from following your invitation.
Okay.
But there you see, opportunism is also a common denominator. You have to promise he who carries much carries something for the most. And if you don't care whether it has anything with realization or practical value to do, you're just there and put out your bait and tackle. That's it. But the other parties, and that is what is a great disillusionment, they were staring, the rabbit staring at the snake. And they've been doing this for years, and now they're...
Well, we're going to discuss that in a bit. But first of all, I just want to go to how effectively the AfD and the Bündnis Wagenknecht exploit perceived problems. And I'm not going to say here that there aren't problems, but
no.
I think the degree with which politicians try to make these problems worse than they are is important. So obviously, they often talk about how East Germany has never sort of achieved the wealth of the West. And it's only kind of true. I mean, over the course of years, 2 trillion euros has been sent from West Germany to East Germany. And the current average monthly wage in the East is 2,850 euros. In the West, it's 3,320 euros. So yeah, we're talking about a difference, but it's not a huge difference. You know, at $500 a month. €3.
And much is cheaper, unless you're unhappy you live in Boston.
Yeah, in real terms, it's much more equal.
Yeah.
The perception of immigration problems. Both of these parties focus on being anti-immigrant, which is bad for a country like Germany, which actually can only survive with new immigrants because of the way that labor market is structured. You know, so people in Saxony and Thuringia are complaining about how many immigrants there are. But in both Saxony and Thuringia, they only have 9% immigrants, as opposed to Baden-Württemberg or Hamburg, where it's 20%. So again, are there immigrants in Saxony and Thuringia? Yes, but less than half of what you would see in Western states.
Yeah.
So those are perception issues that are exploited by these two parties we're discussing. Just a couple of final points I think it's important to make. I have some surveys here from this September. What we can't deny is that people are extremely unhappy in East Germany with the government in Berlin. 84% are unhappy with the coalition government, and Scholz's approval rating is 18, which is the worst in, I think, the modern history of chancellors. And Merkel, when she was the most popular, her lowest point was 40%. So her approval rating at her worst was 40%. It was usually over 50%. Scholz is at 18, which is just dreadful. What do you make of the frustration with the coalition in Berlin?
I think it's quite interesting, and I would like to recondition this a bit. Frau Merkel's strategy has always been, and her enormously long period in office underlines this, never to go into conflict. She would articulate her policy making by research of the public opinion, and whatever is conflictious, she would leave out. The only thing where she didn't do it was saving the euro, but she benefited enormously because Germany had an enormous influx of foreign capital fleeing from the weaker European countries into here. So she didn't have even to pay for her debts. But Scholz had planned a completely different system and start. Then came the Ukraine war that threw it all to smithereens. And he had the unhappy position in a government of conflicting interests between the Liberal Party, which is not liberal what the Americans think is liberal, but it's a lower tax party and please the rich party, and the Greens with their schoolmasterly attitude to re-educate a nation to live up to whatever definitions of climate change. It couldn't be greater. So Scholz had the idea of presiding over it is one thing, but no, he had to fundamentally alter the whole political history of his party, quite close to the Russians, as you know.
Let's just explain that a little bit. Gerhard Schroeder, the previous SPD chancellor, was, I think, might have been literally in bed with Putin. he certainly was figuratively in bed with Putin for a long time. And indeed, yeah. to this very day, is a great apologist for Putin.
He benefited from him, yeah. But all this, and he had a heavy, a massive influence in the party. All that is gone. A total rupture of SPD basic principles and strategies. Right. Total rupture, and that wasn't easy. Scholz isn't a political demagogue. He isn't a great speaker. His debates are very dry and bone dry.
But in the way that Wagenknecht is very charismatic, Scholz is the total opposite of such a politician.
Yeah, but one shouldn't underrate him. He is not a stupid man, and he knows very well. And one of the latest polls I read, now the prognostics for our next year federal election is there is one realistic coalition left, that is the CDU as the strongest party and the SPD. And that might be Herr Scholz, might be somebody else, but probably it will be Herr Scholz. He remains physically and emotionally untouched by all this, which I've rarely seen politicians. You are right. His results are very weak because the three-party government is at each other's throats. The Greens have ruined much with their stupid and silly trying to re-educate the whole nation from a position where they were clearly part of the upper income circles. So what we need is a massive, tangible, social, political initiative. And if you listen, I would have added, but we're out of time probably, what Draghi said in Brussels these days. The European project needs investment.
Yeah, that is indeed a subject for another day. And we'll see if Scholz is the person to do that. Anyway, let's close by just looking at the final elections coming up here in Germany in September, which are coming up in a couple of weeks. And those are in Brandenburg. And mm-hmm. Brandenburg is the area outside surrounding Berlin. Berlin is its own state, mm-hmm. the city. And then surrounding it, it's sort of an island in the middle of this bigger state, which is Brandenburg. And I just got these are the new polls for the Brandenburg election that just came out on Sunday, so just 2 days ago. The AfD is in the lead with 28%. And these polls are good. It turns out the German polling is pretty good. So this is what we can expect. The AfD is at 28%. But here the SPD is at 21%.
Yeah.
So the SPD is much stronger in Brandenburg than in Thuringia and Saxony. The CDU fares much worse,
yeah.
at a mere 17%. Again, the Bündnis Sarrewagenknecht is up to 15%.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the Greens at 5% and the FDP at
1%. Mm-hmm.
So,
rightfully said.
So what do you think? I mean, you believe that we're going to have another AfD win in Brandenburg?
Probably, yes. The prime minister is quite popular, I believe. So that gives for the strength of the SPD there. Brandenburg is a very structured region. You have extremely poor regions and you have abysmally well-to-do. Potsdam is now a hideaway for the much better old. It's extremely expensive if you wish to buy a property there. So I would expect the same, but with less dramatic consequences. Thuringia clearly is the most difficult thing to master. I could expect minority governments, case by case, voting, and in the end, new elections somewhere down the line. I have no idea whether prior to the next federal election or afterwards. Thuringia is difficult. Brandenburg will be a bit easier to manage. Saxony is also, now they negotiate with the Wagenknecht thing, but a formal coalition between the CDU and Wagenknecht, I would rule out. Case by case voting on issues that have nothing to do with wiping out Ukraine and presenting the head of Zelensky
suggesting is since it will be difficult for any party to be a majority yeah. party, what we're going to see is minority governments in all of these regions potentially.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be something that happens. You mentioned the federal elections coming up in 2025.
Yeah.
And we could very well see a new CDU chancellor by the name of Merz. And we will introduce you to him in an episode further down the line. But thank you, Gunter, today for your discussion of the elections in Thuringia and Saxony and for your introduction to Wagenknecht and Höcke. I really appreciate it. Looking forward to doing this again.
Thanks for having me. The pleasure was all mine.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.